You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend.
Tracy, I need you to put your pod seat table in the bottom left corner of the...
Yeah, how it goes. I turn off and turn it back on again.
We couldn't remember who did the last one, so I kind of...
Really couldn't. It's been...
Kind of hybrided it.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. It's fine. Everybody, that was smooth. It's going to work great.
Hybridized. Hybridized?
I guess. Maybe-ish. It's probably a word.
Something like that. Anyway, hi.
Hi. So, you know, it's so I don't always have the chance when we have guests on to read like the whole book that they've done when they're an author with a book coming out. Although I always make a point to read at least some of what there is. But in this case, Molly Tanzer's In Side by Side They Wander is a novella. And so I actually knocked the whole thing out today and finished it like 10 minutes before starting the podcast here with y'all. And so it's very fresh in my mind. And this is an important question, I feel like, to start off, and I need to know the answer, Patrick, and from you too, Molly. What's your favorite museum?
The J. Paul Getty in Los Angeles.
I knew you were going to say the Getty.
So. Yeah, it's either that or the Palace of the Legion of Honor in San Francisco. It's another one of my favorites.
I was just there actually. It was really cool.
It's very nice because it splits between like Greco-Roman kind of stuff and then the French stuff. And
yeah. They had a Matisse and Morisot exhibit.
Oh, nice.
And I was really excited to get to see that because I'm a big fan of, not Matisse, sorry, Manet and Morisot. And they had a really weird relationship that I knew nothing about, but were like extremely weird about each other in really interesting ways. And the exhibit was kind of about that. So it was one of those times where I was in a museum and I was like, oh my God, I'm reading every tombstone. Like, I really have to know everything about these two freaks and their obsession with one another. So they even died in the same way, but like in separate times. I don't. She married his brother because he already had a wife. I don't know. It was a whole
thing. Were they like beefing with each other?
No, like, they were obsessed with each other. Oh. Like, yeah. And yeah, so yeah, they were weird about each other. He was already married. She married his brother. They kept painting one another and like augmenting one another's paintings. And yeah, it was like a whole thing that I just knew nothing about. It was great.
Huh.
I will also throw out that the saddest museum I've ever been to was the Civil War Museum on Lookout Mountain above Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Oh, okay. So what makes it the saddest for I mean, obviously war is bad, but
the very, very strange, poorly constructed miniature map of the Battle of Chattanooga with like LED lights to show like explosions and little like it was I could have done better and I can't fucking paint.
Oh, so the jankness of it was really the sadness. I see.
That kind of sad. Got it.
That kind of sad. That's different.
Although it did. That was the first time I ever got to use that joke. Look out, mountain. Now I get to do it all the time.
And we're so grateful. Thank you, Lookout Mountain. Thank you for that gift. So Molly Tanzer, what's your favorite museum?
That's a hard one because I like very highly specific museums. Like the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam is really amazing, and I love Van Gogh. And like so, being there and surrounded by all of his art was really spectacular. In the same way that we have in Denver, the Clifford Still Museum, and he was a expressionist painter. I think that's right, and he did these huge canvases, very similar to like Pollock, but also sort of diverted away from what the other guys were doing. And so in Denver, and his dying wish was that all of his art be viewed together in isolation from other artists. And so the Clifford Still Museum in Denver has like 98% of his output, including like a bunch of his effects and things. And it's really, really cool. And so like you have museums like that I get super into. And then like you have museums with like a more general collection. And so it's like hard to name just one, but I mean, I don't know. I've been to the Louvre like once meaningfully and it's kind of hard to beat it. Like, But I guess I also have a lot of feelings clearly about the British Museum, because this novella is very much about the British Museum and some of their practices. So, but I do love that museum, but I'm also like, what is going on here, guys? So, yeah, I don't know. It's hard to pick a museum that I haven't really enjoyed. So that's kind of hard.
That's fair. It's a good problem to have, to say, yeah, I have enjoyed too many museums.
I need a squirrel.
Yes.
So I just found out that Molly plays D&D. I went to Genghis Khan in February, and I played Rivers of London.
Oh.
And if you're not familiar with Rivers of London, this is a series of books by, I'm going to mispronounce his last name, but it's Ben Aronovich, I think.
Yeah, they have cool covers.
And so is it Chaosium, I think, made a game based on Rivers of London. And the thing that I played was we had to investigate under the British Museum, because something that was a mummy that was in the British Museum woke up.
Oh, man.
And it's like, why won't you repatriate me?
I love that. Really,
yeah. Fun. Well, no, she woke up because she'd been put in storage and she missed all the kids coming to see her learn about her.
Surprisingly, so she, actually.
Yeah. And so it was a very role play-y session, because mm-hmm. we got to role play with her and essentially find out what was going on and then fix the problem and get her back on display. So when the kids come from school to the British Museum, they still see her and learn about her. And then that made her happy. And so she's happy to go back and be on display. So
that's so cute.
But there's my British Museum connection.
Love it.
So for the benefit of folks who did not mainline the novella, and it would be a neat trick if you could, because we're recording this on April 8th and the novella doesn't come out for like more than a month yet. Yeah. So you would be a time traveler too, which is super cool. I would like to hear more about that time traveling thing that you're doing. But I think we got to kind of sink into the idea of the British Museum and the repatriation.
Tracy, I had a time travel joke and you didn't like it.
We're gonna get an episode in here, I swear. We're also recording this on a random Wednesday evening, which might account for some extra slappiness for all parties intended.
It's been a long day. It's been a long day.
So, like, through the lens of science fiction, we have this very different way of rethinking the problem of art and of history and of acquisition and of belonging and so on. So do you want to maybe give our listeners who haven't had a chance to get their hands on the novella yet, like the quick and dirty, dare I say, elevator pitch? Yeesh.
Sure. You know, I'll also, is it okay if I also like introduce myself a little? I don't like assume that every listener on the podcast will know who I am. So I'll just say that, like, yeah, I'm Molly Tanzer. I've been publishing for a couple of years now. Like, I have a trilogy that unfortunately is sort of as a collection called The Diabolist's Library, which is like a real mouthful. But the first one is Creatures of Will and Temper. That is also a very museum-y book if you like books about art that also have a fantastical element. And recently, I've also been working with the estate of C.L. Moore, Catherine Lee Moore, to revive the pulp heroine Jor-El of Jewelry. So I'm writing official Jor-El stories these days. That's one thing.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's really cool. The estate's really lovely, and I'm working with New Edge Sword and Sorcery magazine, which is a very inclusive sort of approach to sword and sorcery, because it hasn't always necessarily been the most friendly genre to others, but they're doing a great job over there. But in terms of the novella, it has been not inaccurately marketed as an interstellar art heist. And I think that's true. But I am these days, I hilariously looked at my early Goodreads reviews and I got an unhappy one where someone said, I thought this was an art heist. What I got was philosophy. And I am just very grateful to this disgruntled reader, because I think that's just such a great elevator pitch. Like, you think it's going to be a heist, but what you're going to get is some philosophy. It is a very chewy It's a chewy novella about the culture of the copy and what is art and what is an original and what is a fake and what does that mean? And sort of all viewed in the process of trying to get and trying to liberate a few pieces of art from a museum that has acquired them and is keeping them long beyond sort of their how they should be keeping them. So is that a good pitch?
I think so. I mean, I think you're also, you know, by the nature of elevator pitches, having to kind of like pry away some of the more really interesting and inventive and wild elements of your narrative there. And
there's a lot going on in it. It's true.
There is. And one of the things that I think is particularly interesting about it, because it flies in the face of some of what has sometimes been presented as like conventional wisdom for science fiction narratives, is you put specific dates on things. Mm-hmm. And not just because the text is so frequently referencing like pieces of art or artists or things. The dates on things that you're putting are about the near future Earth that has its first contact with the Solarians, the alien species that offers to rescue and preserve our art for us, you know, just until we kind of like, we're a fixer-upper planet, right? We got all this climate change and this killing each other stuff that we're doing, and it's kind of bad. And so they offer us the tools that we could use to kind of, you know, get back on our feet and not suck so much, as it were, while they take care of our art for us and provide us with, you know, some lovely copies so that we can feel that it hasn't actually been taken from us. All of that, you know, hundreds of years down the lane is where we end up with the actual characters in your actual story. But there's a number of interesting timestamps. Like in 2032, there's a gigantic heat wave that's sort of the kind of crescendo of climate change as we know it. In 2037, there's an LLM trained on the speeches of Donald Trump that becomes the de facto leader of the new Confederacy of the United States. There's barf. A number of places where...
Barf.
Yeah, I'm from Florida, so like
it's two sentences. It's two sentences that I think is there as a bit of a warning shot, I think we can say. But those aren't the only places where we get some specific dates. And I think it's really interesting to see that, because so often even near future SF is hesitant to date stamp things because there's that fear that you're going to end up, you know, feeling like William Gibson writing cyberpunk in the 80s, and then you turn around and it's the 90s and suddenly RAM works in a completely different way and the technology has sort of blown past your predictions and so on. So I'm really interested in why giving specific dates for things, even knowing that your actual story itself is going to be set in like 2337, why giving the specific dates that are so close to our now was important to you?
I absolutely love when you watch some old science fiction and like some bad stuff happens and we're past that point in time and you get to think like, oh, wow. Like, cause I, like for example, like how in Deep Space Nine, they travel back to 2024 and there's this thing called the Bell Riots, which sort of set Earth on the right trajectory. And like Captain Sisko, is he captain at that point? Doesn't matter. He goes back to 2024, and I ended up actually finally watching that Deep Space Nine in its entirety, like before that. And it was just really interesting to be like, wow, in 2024, like what's going to be going on? And so, and I have a lot of affection for, wrong science fictional predictions as well. And so this is one of my first long form science fiction pieces. I've done some, short stories and novelettes, but never in novella. And I like to think about like, what do I like in a genre when I start writing in that genre? And that is something that I really, really enjoy. And so I thought it would be fun. Although I wrote the first draft of this in 2023. Is that right? Yeah, in 2023. And I did end up adding in some of the stuff about Mar-a-Lago after the 2024 election. That was a later addition. And then some of the stuff about AI, I kept having, because I wrote that, like, it was a long process to get this. It is strange that I wrote it, like, close to 3 years ago at this point. But I kind of love that because it always kind of was about artificial intelligence. But then as we started seeing more with generative AI, I got a chance while editing it, working with an editor, doing copy edits to sort of see where we were in that conversation and keep updating it sort of around ideas. So I was able to sort of differentiate the actual artificial intelligence in this, the Android, from sort of Gen AI and LLM stuff, which wasn't so much in the first draft because early 2023, we weren't having as many conversations about it. So I don't know. I guess I just kept being so enchanted by seeing the present and moving on that I was like, great, this is going to be so dated so soon. I love it. And I don't know. I just never wanted to take them out because, you know, when you read something like from the 60s, like I've been watching some original series Star Trek, which I've never watched every single episode of that. And some of their predictions for like what 1990 would be like are so charming.
You
know, that's not what it was like. So
no. And it's funny that you meant, because Star Trek, you mentioned Star Trek, Roddenberry thought, you know, there was going to be a World War III. He thought eugenics was going to be huge, like the whole Khan thing. Yeah, it's funny. And then even if you go into the 80s, one of the shows that I liked as a kid that is very hard to watch now was Buck Rogers.
Sure.
But the opening thing, you know, it's 1999 and NASA is launching the last of Earth's deep space probes. That was in the like 79, 80. And they're thinking, you know, oh, the space shuttle is going to be so cool. We're just going to be launching those. And then those are going to be deep space probes. And none of that comes back. And to this day, there are several friends of mine who say that I still can't have a jetpack.
No, rude. It's true.
Yeah.
They say I put my eye out. It's terrible. Yeah.
That was a long and rambling response, but it's a fun question. I've never been asked that, but as such a Trek person, it always has been a thing for me.
Yeah.
You know, even just like, I just think about like when Voyager goes back in time and like we've got Captain Janeway in her like Hillary Clinton suit striding around Southern California. And it's just, this is great, actually. So I didn't really worry about like, will people in 10 years be like, what? Like, I was like, if we're still reading and we're still here, this will be hilarious.
If there are still books in 10 years.
If there are still books, then like, great. Then people will be like, oh man, she was right or she was wrong. And that is kind of fun to me.
And what I think is kind of cool about that is it's a fundamentally different attitude than the sort of like don't date stamp things because you have essentially put an expiration date of some kind on the core of your idea. And the fundamental difference is that frame of thinking says that you want to kind of like, to the extent that such a thing is ever possible, future-proof your creativity, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, your take on it, not to put words in your mouth, seems to be more like, this isn't about being right, and this isn't about future-proofing. This is about capturing this particular idea that I'm having in this particular moment.
Yeah, and I find that it's true. I do think people do try to future-proof and try to make things critique proof. But as someone who came out of academia, like it's just impossible. Right. And I, you know, one of my master's was in humanities with a focus in 18th century literature. And I read a lot of these utopian novels from the 18th century and they're all like, we figured it out. Like we're going to fix this like right now. And then you look at them and it's like, ah, yes, a utopia where just everyone knows their place. Like there's some people who are just the servant class and we need to make them happy in that. And like, you know, and so I think about things like that, where that was not the case, and things that I believed even 20 years ago and things that I believe now and how ridiculous they're going to seem in another 20 years. I'd rather have fun than be right, which, you know, I'm not sure any people I've been in relationships with would necessarily second that. But like, you're never going to be able to future proof it. And there is sort of that aspect of what were people thinking at the time that this was written? Like, you know, thinking about the Bell riots and like when that episode came out with Deep Space Nine, the idea that by 2024, we wouldn't have figured it out, but things would be so bad that we would start the process of figuring them out is a very strange thing to think about in 2026 when that did not happen, right?
Yeah.
Like we did have all these social movements actually that sort of fizzled out because of various reasons that we don't need to get into because we'll all start crying. And so, you know, like, I find it both hopeful and inspiring and also deeply troubling. And I do like to trouble people with my thoughts. So, like, we'll see how it goes in, you know, a couple of years, you know.
Well,
you're getting that heat wave now, so I guess I was off by a couple of years on that one.
Two things. So Trek at that time was still trying to live within the constraints of the timeline as written by Mr. Roddenberry. Mm. What I find interesting about modern Trek is that they're not.
No.
Like they're doing things and they're changing things in that timeline, right? And even going so far in Strange New Worlds is to kind of explain how the timeline is being affected by like time agents and different things that have been happening, you know, behind the scenes. So I think that's funny. The other thing is I sent this around because I tend to communicate almost exclusively through memes at this point with my friends. And if I ever don't send them a meme, they're going to know something's wrong and probably check on me.
Yeah, send a well check.
For the day. But I sent one around to a couple of folks, including Cannoli Joe, who's one of our longtime patrons, Molly. And I've never read the series, but Pretty Little Liars.
It's a book I've seen.
Yeah.
They are – the publisher has been updating it with to change the pop culture references to more modern things. And one of the things that they posted as an example was in the original book, it said, hey, do you want to come over and watch Fear Factor?
Okay.
Because they're going to make somebody eat bugs tonight or something like that.
Right.
They updated it, and I'm using sarcastic air quotes for the listeners right now. They updated it with, hey, do you want to come over and watch a TikTok?
Oh, just the one.
And that's like,
don't stay long, please.
Yeah, that's like my aunt's going, hey, you want to come with us to Walmart's?
Yeah.
The TikTok. Do you want to come over and watch the TikTok?
Is this on your Facebooks? TikTok. Because it's not on my Facebooks.
Yeah. I don't know how I feel about that at all. I mean, I know how I feel terrible. About watching TikTok, but like, that is Yeah, I don't know. I don't hold with that. I think it's okay. I think it's cool to read a book that's all books are written in a place and a time, obviously, but then it's interesting to sort of, I don't know. As a history weirdo, I like to see those kinds of artifacts
That really kind of gets at one of the core, like the Goodreads reviewer who was like, get this philosophy out of my heist. Like someone put this philosophy in the middle of my heist novel.
Peanut butter is on my chocolate.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. Like that idea of, so the Salarians have given us the means by which to create as close to a utopia as humanity is ever likely to achieve. It's at least, you know, highly livable and sustainable, and poverty and starvation are a thing of the past and so forth. But, you know, they took all of our art, or at least the vast majority of it, and they've given us the ability to have plenty of copies of it, you know, and to display them in any means and types and ways that we like. But it's that hunger for the original, because the original is an artifact of place and of space and of the hands that made it and all of that, that kind of animates these characters' desire to go get the originals back. Like we know we have these copies, but it's not the copies that we want. We want what we originally had. And one thinks that, like, if they were to say, well, how about we just go swapsies, like give us our originals back and you can have all the copies, right? You know, you've got the schematics for them or whatever now, that the Salarians wouldn't accept that, because like you, they value the kind of ineffable intrinsicness of this is the thing made by this person, or this is the one and only of this in its true form. And I guess that kind of brings us back to that whole idea of like the culture of the copy, because you made that reference earlier, and I think it's worth unpacking that a little bit. So when you're talking about the culture of the copy, like what are you thinking of in our world, in your story world? Like what are examples of the culture of the copy that we're living in all the time?
Well, I think, I guess, you know, maybe I'll just get into sort of the the inspiration for this was not only sort of, so I have my undergraduate degree is in art history. And so as is very typical, or at least was, I haven't been in a classroom in a long time, I was given Walter Benjamin's The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction to tangle with when we moved to the advent of photography. And Walter Benjamin said that when we mechanically reproduce a work of art, so like when you take a picture of the Mona Lisa and then you look at it, you have a different experience than you would when you're in the Louvre and you're looking at La Joconde. And so, and that's because a photograph, there's no actual distance. You can't understand the distance between you and the object that you're looking at. It distorts our reality. So, and there's like an even better example sort of, which is like when everyone looks at the moon and they're like, wow, the moon looks cool tonight. And then you take a picture of the moon and it sucks. Like that's because you're not having an experience of yourself in the moon anymore, right? The moon is on your phone. It's not up in the sky. You don't know that there's somebody knows the exact miles that we are to the moon. I do not, but like, you know, like, it's different. And he calls it the subtle weave of space and time. And he describes the sort of sensation that we get from originals as aura. I don't think it's aura farming. I think that we're blessedly before that kind of lingo. But and so I read that and it just is really interesting because Benjamin actually comes down on the side of it being good that there's mechanical reproductions of works of art. And I have to say, I agree with him, even if I love originals, because I mean, I got my art history degree in Central Florida, where there's not a ton of museums to go and look at. You know, at the time, the Tampa Museum of Art had a great classics collect, like Red Figure and Black Figure pottery collection. But I really had to go out of my way to find like a really good museum. But I still got a great education and I've used it pretty much every day of my life. I love that degree. And I loved my experience. And without the ability to take pictures, I would not have had that. I would have had to go on like my grand tour, like an 18th century nobleman or something, right? So he's a fan of it. It democratizes art, even if it demystifies it. And that's a hard thing to sort of come down on. And then in 2020, I read an article about how a group of sort of, it might be rude to call them, but tech bros had basically been like, okay, we've figured out how to fix the problem of the Parthenon marbles. And, you know, the Parthenon marbles are in the British Museum. They were taken from Greece by a Scottish nobleman named Lord Elgin, which basically probably saved them because at the time the Parthenon was being used as a munitions warehouse by the Ottomans. And there was an explosion that very much damaged the Parthenon. They're restoring it now, but it was heavily damaged by that. And probably Lord Elgin did save these sculptures, but he then had financial difficulties and sold them to the British Museum where they reside to this day, even though Greece and UNESCO and other people have been like, it's probably time to give them back to Greece. And so these tech guys are like, okay, like, here's what we're going to do. We're going to scan the Parthenon marbles with lasers and create digital uploads and then quarry the same marble from the same place and then use like technology, more lasers to like carve perfect reproductions that are indistinguishable from the original. And then like, who cares, right? Like Greece can have the reproductions and England can keep the originals, or England can keep the original or keep the, you know, the copies, and we can give the originals back to Greece. And Greece was like, what are you talking about? We don't want phony
forgeries. Yeah, we don't want forgeries.
We don't want your crummy reproductions. And the British Museum was like, we will see you in court, right? It was this is really interesting situation. And I was like, wow, like even my least woo friends are so appalled by the idea of trying to make perfect fakes of the Parthenon marbles that this is really something to think about in the context of this essay I had read like 20 years before that. And so when I was thinking about the culture of the copy, it's not just sort of like memes or the things that we sort of see in this infinitely reproducible milieu that we have ended up in here in 2026, where authenticity, especially in this AI era, is very, very distorted. Like how many pictures have I seen just in the past few days that are AI generated pictures of the Artemis project. And it's like, just wait for NASA. Like, they're going to release them. And instead, it's just been like, my timeline has been like slop on Facebook with people being like, this is so inspiring. And I'm like, like, do I tell them? I don't know. Like, I don't know. But we have this sort of anxiety around authenticity right now. And I think that this is an interesting moment when it comes to like what is real and what is fake. And so I don't know. Sorry, I've been talking for a long time. So maybe I should yield the floor because I can get really
I mean, I think, and I'm glad you bring up AI too, because I was thinking about that a lot as I was finishing my read of the book. Because we have an opportunity in the book to hear a Solarian speak for themselves in terms of their, what motivates them. Mm-hmm. You know? And I couldn't help but think to myself, I'm like, all right, again, using the term not entirely without a pejorative lean, that, you know, the sort of the tech bro argument for AI, like the generative or so-called generative forms of AI that create language and images and so on, is that it kind of democratizes the creative process and it gives people more access or more flexibility with that, you know, makes its production more rapid, more fluent, more whatever. And I couldn't help but wonder to myself, like, if the Solarians peaked in on this timeline, slightly separate from the timeline that you suggest in your own book, right? And we're to see what's coming out of, you know, the now shut down Sora or other things like that in the world of AI generation. Would they say, like, huh, that's an interesting tool set. Yes, yes, we will take that. Or would they look at that and go, like, no, that's not what we're talking about here.
I would think that they would do the latter. Yeah. I probably at this point notoriously, at least to anybody who still follows me on social media, anti-generative AI. I don't feel that it is a democratizing tool. I would resist those arguments if this was what we were talking about today, which we're not, but don't get me started. Like, oh my God, this is even worse than the British Museum. Like, I'll never stop talking, but I think that they would probably reject all of that. If only maybe to do, I mean, sometimes in museums you'll see where they'll have a work of art and then they'll have like other iterations of it. Like you'll sometimes see, you know, like pieces inspired by it. And
yeah,
I
artists like responding to the work of other artists.
Yeah. And other sorts of things, or like a movie clip or like whatever. And I think that's really cool. And I think that the only, I guess, I don't know why I'm saying I think this, I invented them, but like, I guess if I were to be editing this now, it would be interesting perhaps to have them have taken something, because like one of the first things that we saw with Gen AI in terms of images was people being like, oh, well, like what didn't Da Vinci paint in the background of the Mona Lisa? Like, now you can kind of see at the edges, like what this, you know, tool thinks might have been outside of that frame. And it's like, I don't know what, like most people write and paint and create music on purpose. Like there's a purposeful cropping there. Like he put everything in the painting that he presumably wanted to be there. So like, why is this interesting? But it would be interesting, I think, to sort of, if they had had some kind of printout like that of what people were doing with Gen AI as sort of like a, you know, what do you think, which museums will often do, along with their language of like, the artist invites us, this such and such, they'll also be like, well, what do you think about this? Like, do like, and ask a question about it. And that could be an interesting thing, but I would think that their concern with authenticity and their interest in the actual creations of art producing species would exclude generative AI images entirely, as that's not what they are.
Yeah. Fair.
People email me if they're mad. I don't know. I invite it. Like I've thought about this a lot over the past couple of years. So I definitely have my stances.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. No doubt. So, all right. That's a lot of ground to cover there. And I've got like, no. I've got like 100 other notes written out here, but I do think it's like, I do want to acknowledge your background in this too. You've already referenced, you know, having studied art history and having your master's in humanities and so on. But I feel very strongly that, that Fennel, our perspective character, is in some ways adapted out of some of your own experiences and maybe some of your own points of view, right? Sure. And so I'm kind of curious about, was there ever a moment where could the narrator of this book ever have been anyone other than Fennel, in the sense of like, does it need to be like, this is a version of Molly speaking this book to us?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting, I have a lot of thoughts on point of view and first person and all these different things. I think that this story could be told from a different point of view, but I don't think that, I think a version of the story could be told from a different point of view, but Fennel really is the anchor of this book. Like, her experiences and her thoughts are what sort of frame this narrative and how she's telling it to us in both playful ways and unreliable ways. Her experiences are in many ways based on mine. I did also leave academia, not for her same reasons, but I did choose a different path than that. One of my favorite sections in this book is this bit where Fennel talks about how one time a friend once said to her, "Love without reciprocation is obsession." And she was like, "What are you talking about? Like, that's crazy." And they sort of duked it out. And that's actually a real experience I had. I was hanging out with a friend one time and he just like busts out with, "Love without reciprocation is obsession." And I was like, I'm going to need to just pump the brake on this conversation and talk about this immediately. And so I felt that it would give her a real sense of being a real person were I to populate her experiences with similar ones of my own and thoughts that I've had about art and reproductions and copies, because I think that at least my goal was to sort of give her a more wide-ranging psyche and set of beliefs that would be the backdrop of the story that I was trying to tell. So it would be fun to sort of do an experiment where this was a different kind of story, but given, I don't want to talk about the ending so much, but given the events of the ending, it really has to be Fennel's story.
Yeah.
He has to be the one telling it.
And I do think like the concept of like, how do we respond to copies? Like, it's very rooted in Fennel's experience and by extension, your own experience and thinking, but it's also like interwoven in so many different elements of the text. And this is, I feel like a bad, member of an audience at a con where it's like, this isn't a question so much as a comment.
No, go for it.
But my not question so much as it is a comment here is, I do think it's really interesting all the different types of copies that are sometimes explicitly referred to as copies, or we're only sort of asked to think of as being sort of different versions of copying. You know, we have obviously what's happening with art and the Salarians having stepped in to both rescue and rob humanity at the same time. We have the copying of a trillionaire tech magnet by way of cloning, but also by way of androids and synthetic humans. We have copying by way of the sort of fungal mimics that end up showing up from the giant fungus consciousness. There's a lot of weird happening in this 90 odd pages. You really kind of jam. You see how much weird we can fit in this little guy.
Yeah, that was sort of one of my goals. It was like, this baby can hold so much science fiction in it.
Yep,
like,
right here, pat the hood of the novella. But in a way, also, and you're going to have to get me on this because I could think of about four different ways of saying this, but like the chick chick. The chick chick alien species are not copies per se, but they have a kind of hive mindedness and a kind of unanimity of both. They are individually, that is a chick chick, and that is also chick chick, and these are all chick chick, and the ship is chick chick, and everything is chick chick. Mm-hmm. In the sense of, it's not quite the same as a copy, but a sense of like undifferentiatedness, which I don't know, the whole story invites a certain sitting back and wrestling with the idea of like, why why do I care so much about individuation and about separate identities of things? And like, do I care about it in all the different spaces and ways that I think that I do? And I think it's quite an accomplishment for 90 odd pages to make that happen.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thank you. Yeah, it's always been on my mind. I have always been very interested in the idea of copying and maybe it, I mean, not to talk about Star Trek on this entire podcast, that's not about that, but
you will not make our listeners unhappy if you
okay,
did so,
well,
though.
Good, because like, I mean, my Android character is not Data, but I definitely, he was like my crush character back in like my early days. And like, you know, like, does this robot have feelings is always something that I'm going to be like, oh, tell me more. Like, I would like to have this conversation about like, what is emotion and can it be mapped onto the synthetic and like, what does that mean? And so ever since I was small, I've been very interested in this idea of what makes us us and what makes us not us. And I find that so wild. And how do we make copies and then have them be different? I mean, like when we, you know, like when you draw a mustache on the Mona Lisa, right? Like when you do these different things, there's artists who have played with this idea forever. And I think it's something that fascinates us broadly, because otherwise, like, why would we be so worried about authenticity? And why would we be so worried about who we are as opposed to who other people are? And I find animal intelligence fascinating. And insect intelligence is one of those things that I think we're critically underappreciative of in this world. I think a beehive is one of the most fascinating things on earth. And, you know, I think most of us only think about them when we're like, it's time for honey. And so like, I kind of wanted to try to attempt to think about how if an insect type species attained, I think it's sapience is the word that we're using now. Then like, what would that look like if they figured it out and like got to space? And like, how would that be? How is it different than the concept of the bug-eyed alien, which has always been a science fictional staple? How would it differentiate itself and be similar? And I wanted to play a little bit with that.
You know what I want to play with, Patrick?
Picks of the week.
I sure do.
We'll get to picks of the week. Just hold your horses. We'll get there. Before we do, I wanted to talk to you for just a second about $5. I know. You're shaking your head now. Look, they say that $5 doesn't go as far as it used to, and they're kind of right. Can you get a cup of coffee for $5 these days? Some of you are saying yes. Like a black coffee, right? You could get a small black coffee probably for $5 somewhere. But you're not going to be able to get one of the fancy ones with the stuff in it. Shot of this, shot of that. Those are going to cost you a lot more. So that $5 is not going to get you that. But you know what? There's a place where you can get a ton of value for just $5 a month, and that is patreon.com/functionalnerds. Let me break it down for you. $5 a month, and you gain access to things like our super secret Facebook group, which has been going on forever, our brand new and popular so far, I'm enjoying it, a lot of other people are enjoying it, but our brand new Discord server, which is also super secret. Can't get there from anywhere else. You have to be a patron of the Functional Nerds to get there. You get a monthly video hangout. And those are really cool. That's me and Tracy host. And the patrons like you, if you become one, get to hang out with us. And we all chat and we talk about the things that are going on in the world and have a little bit of a nerdy conversation. We talk about books sometimes and movies and other things. So you get that for $5. And on top of all of that, one of our most popular things that listeners absolutely love, you get the Patreon exclusive episode of the pod that we call Just Us. That is just me and Tracy talking about stuff. And by the way, if you joined today, you would get all the back episodes of that, I believe, which is kind of cool. And that's all for $5 a month. I mean, come on. What are you waiting for? Head over to patreon.com/functionalnerds and help us keep the lights on and keep this thing we call the Functional Nerds Podcast rolling on. While you do that, you don't have to like pull your earbuds out or stop listening. We're just going to jump right into the other thing that listeners really, really love. It's called Picks of the Week.
So, Patrick, now that you've been freed from the clutches of your barking dog, hi, Ronan, Auntie Tracy loves you, even though you kidnapped Patrick. What is your pick of the week, sir?
My pick is what I showed you guys before we even started recording. So I recently did my very first ever Pathfinder Society GMing at a local game store. And what I wanted to do, so there was another group of players who were doing Savage Worlds at the same time. They brought in pizza for everybody in the whole place. Nice. And so what I wanted to do was I wanted to buy a thing of mystery dice and give it to the pizza guy, the guy who bought all the pizza. And then I also wanted to buy another one and randomly give it away. That didn't happen because I had the hard table. I had the level 3 and 4s. And so it was more complicated than the other guy who had level 1s and 2s. And so like everybody left and it was just my table left at the end. So I ended up buying 5 of these and handing them out to everybody. Instead, I'm just kidding, like 2. But it's essentially a mystery dice set and it looks like a mimic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's in a little cardboard box. And this is from Chessex. And if you know Chessex, you know that they have, we'll say inexpensive dice as opposed to, you know, really expensive dice. And it was kind of cool because you just squeeze the sides and it's perforated. And then once you squeeze the sides, you pull up and it becomes like a monster's mouth.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then
you have the classic Chessex box inside.
And then you just have random dice inside and different colors and stuff. These are purple, which are kind of cool. And because I am fucking old, I like these because they do have enough contrast on them that I can actually
see the numbers. They sometimes get a little too cute with the designs and the
contrast. Yeah. But these were not horribly expensive. And I like the gimmick of the box versus just like a random plastic bag. So that's my pick this week is the Chessex mystery dice.
Fun.
I thought so. And it wasn't at all a last minute thought as we sat down to record and I realized I didn't have something. It wasn't that at all.
Well, I mean, why would it be? we know you study these things carefully, sir.
Yeah, I will say this. I also played Starfinder on Saturday, and I sat down. The GM like takes his big bag of dice and dumps them in his little tray, and I hear this kid go, "That's a lot of dice." And I just turned and looked at him, and I go, "That's not a lot of dice. At most, that's like a third of a lot of dice."
Ah, sweet summer child.
And he's just staring at me, eyes big and wide, like, wow, that's not a lot of dice. Anyway.
Not yet, kid. Not
come for
yet.
The role play. Stay for the crippling addiction to shiny math rocks.
Mm-hmm.
Shiny math rocks. Molly, how about you? What's your pick for the week?
You know, I had something completely different that I was going to talk about, but the presence of the mimic box. I've always been sort of an anime enjoyer. I fell away from it for a while because there just became like a lot of it when I wasn't renting it on VHS tapes from like Past, Present, Future Comics. But a series that I've really gotten into and that I think the second season is about to come out is called Frieren. And Frieren, it's on Netflix. It's also, you can also read, if you read manga, the manga version is through Viz Media and it's on the Viz Media app. So you can read them online, which is really nice. But Frieren is the story of an elf and sort of the Tolkien model of like she's 1,000 years old and, you know, barely middle-aged at that point. And it's called Frieren : Beyond Journey's End because at the start of this series, Frieren and her companions are finishing up a 10-year quest to kill like the Demon King or something like that. And they've done that and they have come home. And that's when the story begins. Like, she's like, cool, I'll see you guys later. And they're like, you're just leaving? And she's like, yeah, like, we barely know each other. We've only been together for 10 years. Like, why should I care about any of you? And then comes back like 50 years later and sees them as older people. And then this, most of the story takes place like 80 years after this adventure that happens like in the past. And she is sort of realized that it's maybe time to get to forge relationships and get to know humans. And maybe there's something there with friendship. Maybe there's something there with a community. And it is so charming. And I wouldn't necessarily say feel good. Like, when I first watched the anime, I definitely teared up, but I'm going to say probably like 75% of the episodes made me like, oh my God, it's so good. Mm-hmm. But I just think it's really gentle, interesting thoughts on the meaningfulness of life and community and like really what it would be like to be like a functionally immortal elf. I've never really seen anything that felt as interesting about that as this. So that, and she, and I, and the mimic thing is because Freyrin is like a powerful mage. She's been alive for 1,000 years, but like she is incapable of passing by a treasure chest without trying to see what's inside, even when people are like, that's a mimic. And she's like, no, not this time. And then they have to get her out of it every time, because even though she's so wise and experienced, like, she just is like, well, I don't know, what if there's something good in there? And so your mimic box was like, you know what, through this,
this
other
is a sign.
Yeah, it's so enjoyable. So
that's is awesome. Hilarious. All right, so
Tracy, what board game are you picking this week?
Yeah, what's the pick of the
week? The board game I'm picking this week, you say that half joking, or perhaps 70% joking, but you are 100% right. So for Easter, Housebeast got me a new game, which is a 2-5 player game, but according to the wisdom of BoardGameGeek.com, which is rarely wrong, it plays best with two, and we've been playing the hell out of it with two over the last couple of days. It's called Forest Shuffle. It's not super new. It came out in 2023. And as you might guess from the title, it's a card-based game that has, surprise, surprise, a forest theme to it. It's the kind of game that, to be 100% honest with you, I'm a little surprised Housebeast bought for me, because it has a lot of markers of the types of games that I don't generally like. So it's a card-based game, and I'm not always gigantically big on card-based games. The other thing about it is, because it's a card-based game and there's obviously very limited space on the cards for language, it tends to be very icon-driven. And I don't thrive with icon-driven cards trying to communicate to me the details of sometimes very complicated card interactions and rules and stuff. I look at the pictures and my mind goes, brr, I want language. And so that was another sort of thing to it. But he read the reviews, he believed in it, he brought it home, and he was right to have done so. So the premise of Forest Shuffle is you've got a gigantic deck of cards, and you're going to try and create a tableau in front of yourself where you're going to make trees, and they have all sorts of different types. There's oaks and larches and lindens and horse chestnuts and whatever. And in these trees, you are going to create little ecosystems, and you can plant things, which are the other cards. And I'm using the word plant advisedly. You don't always make plants. Sometimes it's animals, or insects or other stuff. And you do this by taking these other cards from your hand and tucking them to the left, to the right, above or below a given card. So every tree can support up to 4 other cards on it. And they interact in all sorts of interesting ways. And so every card that has something that can be modifying a tree is divided either up and down or left and right. And that tells you where and how you can place it on other cards. And it's got all these sort of cool synergies. Like, if you've got a fox, then there's certain types of hair that you want to have around. And if you've got this many hair and this many foxes, you get this many more acorns. And you get a bunch of acorns, you win the game, whatever. It sounds, as I'm describing it here, like kind of a sort of throwaway thing, but the replay value is sort of huge. And although I was a little bit worried about the learning curve on it, because again, not huge on symbols, the way that the end game mechanic is designed really helps kind of keep the time train down. The game is always going to run in less than an hour. And part of the reason for that is the game is triggered because winter is coming, is how you know that the game is going to end. There are three different winter cards that get strategically shuffled into different thirds of the deck. And once the third winter card comes out, whenever you're doing a draw, that's the end of the game. And the first time we played the game, the third winter card didn't come out until we'd almost run through the whole deck that was left. And so it was like about an hour. And the second time we played the game was over in 25 minutes because all three winter cards came out in the space of like a 10 card draw. So bad shuffle, Husbies. Bad shuffle. But in any case, the point is that it has huge replay value. It'd be really easy for younger players to pick up, even for people who are kind of games phobic. It's an easy teach. It has a real interesting range of players from 2 to 5, but it works really well as a duos game. And again, I'm remembering that one of our patrons a little while back was asking about what are some good card-driven games that work for kids. You might want to check out Forest Shuffle, Robert.
Wow, you just like drop patron names in an episode? That's my thing.
Sorry. next episode, I'm just going to come with like the whole roster and I'm just going to read them off like it's roll. Like, oh, Todd, you're tardy. Yeah. Like, yeah. You're going to have to send you to the principal's office. All right. So, well, we've managed to make quite a go of it here. Molly, it's been lovely talking to you. So where can people find you and the super cool things that you make?
Oh, it's been lovely being here. This has been really, really fun. Thank you so much for having me on. I am on the internet occasionally. I have a website that's just my name, mollytanzer.com. I am most on Blue Sky and Instagram these days. I think my name... Actually, I think I'm the seed oil sommelier right now on Blue Sky. But if you see a Molly Tanzer, that's me. There's not a lot of us. But yeah, Instagram and Blue Sky is where I hang out most. And Side by Side They Wander will be out May 19th. It looks great. The artist for the cover is Alex Ekman-Lawn, who actually is like a gallery artist. He's done some other covers too, but he has amazing work. And everyone should look at his Instagram, which is also his name. It'll be in hardcover, which is a new thing for me. I've never had a hardcover book. So that's exciting. And then most of what I've been working on has been with New Edge Sword and Sorcery, which are, you can buy digital and print, like glossy, beautiful, old-fashioned magazines, like with like, and Oliver, the editor, is very into like, oh, well, is the paper good enough? So if you're into magazine as object, they're great. They're available online at newedgeswordandsorcery.com, I think, or maybe it's Brackenberry Books. I don't know. But if you type in New Edge Sword and Sorcery, you will find them.
There.
And that's where my Jarell of Jewelry stories can be found. So
that's awesome.
Yeah. Thanks so much.
No, thank you. This has been really fun.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode or any of our episodes, please, please consider sharing it with your friends on social media and give us a like or some stars on the platform or the podcatcher that you're listening to us on. Those likes help with the nasty little algorithm so new people can find us when searching for good stuff to listen to. If you'd like to keep up with the Functional Nerds on social media, the official podcast socials are as follows. At the-functional-nerds on Facebook. At functionalnerds_podcast on Instagram. Shut up. I couldn't get the same one. It just didn't work that way. So hush. And you know what? It's going to get worse here. And at thefunctionalnerds.bluesky, which is BSKY, .social. I know I couldn't keep a copacetic. I tried, but hush. Tracy and I have our own accounts. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky. You can find us by searching. If you want me, it's ATFMB because that's just my handle everywhere I go. Or you can search for Tracy Townsend and find Tracy on social as well. Our Patreon helps keep the lights on and new episodes like this one coming out week after week, which we've been pretty good at. I mean, we're very consistent. So you might consider checking us out over at patreon.com/functionalnerds just to support the pod and help us out there, you know? It does help. Thanks again for listening. And I have one question for you before I go. Is it baseball season yet?
Mr. Carpiers.
You got it right. How about that?
Yeah.
You can call me Cannoli Joe.
Hello, Cannoli Joe.
If you've never listened to the podcast, there's two different styles here. There's Tracy, who does prep work and comes up with some very thoughtful questions. And then, oh, squirrel.
Oh, for God's sake, Patrick Louise.
Hello, Patrick. It is I, Clayface.
Okay. That's probably a good enough signal.
When someone comes up to me and says, hey, I really love what you do, I'm like, I'm sorry, do you know who I, like, I think you have me confused with someone else.
The whiz bang and the gosh wow and the sense of wonder stuff.
My favorite thing about time travel is I actually had a time travel joke for you guys, but you didn't like it.
I'm so excited.